Today's Teisho will be on Case 47 in the Mumon Kan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 47 is entitled Tosatsu's Three Barriers. Tosatsu Etsu Osho set up three barriers for his disciples. One, you leave no stone unturned to explore profundity, simply to see into your true nature. Now I want to ask you, just at this moment, right now, where is your true nature? Two, if you realize your true nature, you are free from birth and death. Tell me, when your eyesight deserts you at the last moment, how can you be free from birth and death? Three, when you set yourself free from birth and death, you should know your ultimate destination. So when the four elements separate, where will you go? Mumon's comment, if you can put turning words to these three questions, you are the master wherever you may stand and command Zen whatever circumstances you may be in. If that is not the case, listen, gulping down your meal will fill you easily, but chewing it well can sustain you. Mumon's verse, this moment's thought sees through eternal time. Eternal time is just this moment. If you see through this moment's thought, you see through the man who sees through this moment. On the altar, today we have two pictures of two people, three photos. Several of them are of my first teacher, Takabayashi Genki Roshi. One was taken during a summer, and I invite you to take a look at them before you leave. One was taken during a summer sesshin at our mountain temple, Tokuganji. We bought some property many years ago to be a temple, a rural retreat center. And we looked all over Washington State, and we found some property at the edge of a national forest on the top of a mountain, basically. And it had a spring running right through it. So it was quite an amazing place in itself, and we would go up there and have what Genki Roshi called Samu Sesshin, or work sesshin. And we would get up at 4:30 in the morning and follow the regular morning schedule through breakfast, and then we would have sit after breakfast, and then we would work until late in the until afternoon sutras. And we did everything to create this beautiful building, this beautiful zendo. We basically, one of our members was an architect, and he drew up the plans. And another person was basically a cabinet maker and had a woodworking shop. And we created all the roof trusses, and we built windows. And we carted it all up there in trucks. Amazing, but we did it all. In the summer, we would have a sesshin in the zendo, which still had plywood floors, and for a while it had no windows. We didn't have a kitchen at that time. We eventually built a separate kitchen building. But at this time we had a tarp over basically part of the kitchen. And the other part was just open to the sky, and we had a big fireplace made of stones. And we would cook right on the open fire. We would make rice and all kinds of food right on an open fire. And the picture, the closest to me, the picture on the altar shows Genki Roshi. We had a big pouring from a big jar, a big jug rather, of soy sauce, show you, into a Dutch oven where we were cooking lunch. And behind him is a woman I trained with for many years named Karen Friedlander, who is an art professor now in Seattle. She's really a wonderful artist. And these were really quite memorable experiences. You know, we would leave Seattle and drive across the mountains. It would be like a 3-hour, 2.5-hour drive, and we would get to a little town called Clay Ellum and turn north. And the farther you drove, the more remote the countryside became. And that area is quite dry, actually, in the valleys. It's really a wheat country and a cattle country. So you would be driving across a rather beautiful desert, and then we would ascend into the mountains where there were rich stands of trees, both hemlock and fir and aspen. And we would drive for many miles into the mountains until we came to our beautiful property. And then we would have sesshin and work during the day and sit in the morning and at night. And Genki did a lot of the cooking, and it was always delicious. And I remember sitting in that zendo with no windows across from him. And it was just the most wonderful thing in the world. You know, that was such a beautiful spot. And we would we were all really practicing Zen wholeheartedly. And the combination of just being out in the natural world in this exquisite place and just being out there was so wonderful. And getting up and doing vigorous physical work, and the morning, you know, smelling the clean air in the morning, and the smell of the fire. At the end of the day, we would all take baths in a 50-gallon drum. We had a drum mounted on cinder blocks, and under it we would build fire. And we had buckets to wet ourselves down. And we had laid stones on the ground so that you wouldn't get dirty when you were washing. And there was a big rope between two trees, so you could close it off so the women could have their bath time first. And it was very discreet. And then the men would get it afterwards. It was just a wonderful, wonderful experience. I'll never forget it. In the spring, all the little flowers would come up. Sometimes we would see elk in the distance. And, that area of Washington State is cattle country. So, actually, the cattle people have the right to allow their cows to graze in the high country where we were. Every once in a while, cows would just move across our property. They had the right to do this. And we would hear them in the morning calling moo. You know. So we were all going in to see Genki Roshi in Dokusan. And at that time, we were holding Dokusan in a tent outside the zendo. So we would go into his tent and call moo. And we were all sitting in the zendo, and we could hear the cows calling moo. And one time we were in deep concentration, and there was a cow right next to the building, and it just moo, and we all burst into laughter. And Genki said, you know, something so true. He said, the difference between your moo and that cow's moo is the cow is totally natural. So more practice on the cushion. At that time, my job was to be Inji to Genki Roshi. And he had a tent away from the Zendo where he was sleeping. And every morning before the sun would come up, I would heat water so he could wash his face. And I would take it to his tent, basically a basin of heated water and soap and a cup of tea with a lid on it, you know. And that gave me such great pleasure. We had wonderful experiences up there. And sitting next to Genki was always this really... he would sit so deeply. I'm sorry that the people here haven't had the opportunity to meet him. I first met him at a sesshin many years before we built our temple. I think it was 1977. And he had just come from Japan, and he was leading a sesshin, and I had never been to a sesshin. I almost died, I think, at that sesshin. It was so difficult. But there was something about Genki's tone when I would go in to see him privately that was deeply inspiring. He was a person, I thought, of really extraordinary kindness and compassion. We sometimes had visiting Zen teachers who would come to our group in Seattle and lead sits and even sesshin. And some of these people could be quite tough customers, you know, very abrasive and very difficult to deal with. But Genki was a very grandmotherly, you know, he was always extremely kind. And I can remember going in to see him in Dokusan and just being at my last, on my last legs, you know, just absolutely wiped out during sesshin. And he would just say something to me that would lift my spirits, you know, and I would go back to the cushion reinvigorated. One of the first memories I have of him is coming into the building where we were having sesshin and seeing him mop the floors. Later, during that same sesshin, we had rats in the kitchen. And everybody was very worried about the rats, you know. And Genki Roshi, during one of his teishos, talked about growing up in Japan at a temple where they had rats. And he said, in Japan, people, at least country people, think of rats as a good omen. And he said, if a rat lives there, it's got to be a pretty good place to live. he said, naturally, we're not going to do anything to hurt the rats. We just want to make sure that they can't get into our food. So every night at the end of while we were sitting late into the night, around 9 o'clock, we could hear the rats in the kitchen squeaking. And it changed the way I thought about rats. But it was another example of his extraordinary compassion, you know, just a person who really embodied that loving kindness, which is so important to Zen. You know, when I first met him, I was, deeply impressed because he could sit so beautifully. And having done sesshins for many, many years before I ever met him, he... made it look effortless, because I think it was for him. I wanted to be like him, you know. That was a teacher-student relationship. When I met him, I thought he was extraordinarily... He was the kindest person I had ever met in my life. And he was probably one of the gentlest, maybe the gentlest person I had ever met in my life. And I wanted to be kind and good like that. And so I wanted to be his student more than anything in the world. And I was quite a good student, I would say. You know, I tried to show up for all the sits. I tried to go to all sesshins for many, many years. And I can't really say that I got to know him very well. You know, we had a student-teacher relationship. I was always sort of on my best behavior with him. And he was always trying to teach me something. You know, it wasn't like a casual. There were people in the Zen group he would go fishing with and unwind, and he never allowed me to be that close to him. I think he was always training me. He was always, it was a little bit like I had to be on my guard when I was around him, because he wanted me to be awake. And he didn't really cut me too much, any slack, I would say. He was never harsh, but he asked a lot of me, and I respected that very much of him. So, at any rate, most of you have probably heard that he died on Sunday, this last Sunday. He was 81 years old, and he had been suffering from congestive heart failure, and he had been in a car accident a number of months ago, and that had also pushed his health over the edge. And I have to say that I didn't have any, I was sitting on Sunday, but I didn't have any intimation or any intuition that he died. I had no idea. And I didn't really find out until I got an email from the editor of Sweeping Zen, and he asked me if I'd like to write something in memoriam for Genki. And that was the first I had heard about it. At the same time that all of this was happening, with Genki's passing away, news came to us unexpectedly this week that Sandy Spina had experienced a really terrific loss, you know. Her grandson, who was 2 years old, named Nathan, died in the night. And she got a call at 4:30 in the morning, she was informed that he had died. And they still don't know why he died. They think there might be some congenital heart defect or some other problem of that kind that was completely undiagnosed. You can imagine how, I myself don't have children. My wife and I don't have children. I have been taking care of my elderly parents as they died. And we've taken care of my wife's father recently until he died. And that's difficult. It's difficult one day to wake up and realize you have no parents anymore. You know, that's quite a moment in life. You realize you're an orphan, basically, you know. And that's a shocking moment, actually. You might not think it will amount to much, but when it happens to you, it actually is very resonant. You suddenly realize, you know, these people you would like to call up on the phone no longer exist, and the people you have been depending on for 50 years are gone. You know, 50 some years. That's a shock. But it must be absolutely unbelievably painful to lose a child like that. I have not gone through that, but I can only imagine that must be the worst experience in the world. A few years ago, my brother died of bone cancer. And he was very sick for a long time, and he died before my mother died. And my mother, I could see it was really difficult for her to deal with. She was quite reconciled to dying herself, But it bothered her tremendously that her son had died. You know. So I'm sure that Sandy is going through something very difficult. I'm sure her son and her daughter-in-law are in a really a very painful situation. So this week, you know, has been an interesting week. I mean, I have experienced the loss of my teacher, my first parent in Zen. And I've been doing a lot of sitting, remembering what this person was like and how inspiring he was to me and how much I really loved him. And now he is, as we say, gone. Yeah. And Sandy's grandson dying so unexpectedly. You know, this is really like very difficult for her, I'm sure. And just knowing that she's unhappy makes me feel quite unhappy myself. And, you know, I myself have been going through this process of sort of dealing with death, you know. When I was a little boy, my grandfather, who was really the person I loved the most, my mother's father died when I was just a kid, really, like I think I was six or something. And he was really a very loving person, and I had a special rapport with him. I loved my father, but I loved my grandfather, you know, sort of unconditionally. When we would go to visit him, you know, I just couldn't wait to see my grandfather. And he was so warm and friendly, a little bit like Genki, actually. And we would drive around in his truck. He had a truck. He would take me all over and buy me popsicles and things like that. And when he died, it was not really something I could take in. You know, I was just too young. In the last decade, though, you know, my mother died, and then my mother-in-law died, and then my father-in-law died, and then my younger brother died. So I haven't really been paying attention to death very much in my life, and I'm not in a job like Sandy. Sandy has worked in hospice work for so many years. She sees people dying all the time. You know, I haven't had that experience. And my sister is a nurse practitioner in an oncology ward, and I think she sees people die every other day, just about. So these are people who are very seasoned with death, but I have been keeping it at arm's length. And it's this week, it's very much present. So this koan is really an important koan. It's one of the koans people get toward the end of their practice, toward the end of their training. Tosatsu's Three Barriers. And it's really pointing us to this issue of life and death. You know, what is life and what is death? And I suppose I'm not unusual in sort of, imagining that death is not going to affect me, you know. But you know, here it is. You might say this is really the ultimate issue for all of us, right? When we think about the question of death, you know, one way to approach it is to study the science, you know, there are a number of books actually on what happens to you as you die, you know, how you die. My sister is, as I said, an oncology nurse. And she is quite excellent at understanding the dying process. When my mother was dying of cancer, my sister and I were together, and my sister was taking care of her. And my sister you know, would take her pulse and other life signs. And she knew, you know, within a few hours when my mother was going to die. She actually said, I think, you know, mother, I think mother's going to die in about 2 hours. And indeed, she died in about 2 hours, you know. So there's a science of understanding the body and how it transitions from life into death. And of course, there is like a scripture, you know. So there are many different teachings about life and death. You know, in some traditions, people believe in like heaven. And in Islam and in Christianity and in Judaism, there are various ideas about what happens to you after you die. You know, there are people who believe in the idea of a heaven, and even in Buddhism, there are people, Buddhists, who believe in heaven. You know, it's quite conventional for people to draw on scripture, religious tradition, and teachings when somebody dies, you know. Yesterday, a woman came into my office. And she was with her son, and her son had failed English 101. And he had failed because he had not completed the last two papers. And the mother came in with her son, and she sat down, and she said, I want to explain why my son failed the last two papers. His father died at the end of the semester. And we were sitting Shiva for him. We were observing the rites for the dead, and so, you know, naturally I made some kind of an accommodation for him. So, you know, there's a whole scriptural tradition, religious tradition. When people die, we do special things to honor them, and that's another way of approaching it. There's also like philosophical a way of investigating death through philosophy. So actually, there's quite a few books on what death means. You know, if you study existentialism, death is a big deal for them. They see all life is lived in the shadow of death, you know, with death at our back. And everything we do, like wanting to be famous or wanting to be wealthy, all of these are ways of dealing with our mortality, they say, you know. So there's all these different ways of dealing with death, but you know, in Zen, that's not our way. You know, the way we deal with things is different from, say, studying scripture or doing philosophy or studying science. You know, we do Zazen. This might seem, a little strange as a response to death, but that's what we do, you know. So, you know, the basic teaching of Zazen is that we have all the answers to all of our questions available to us in the moment. That's the teaching. It may not be true, you know, and you may not believe it, but that's what we teach. And so when we have a question or a problem, we do Zazen. That's how we try to resolve the issue. And it's a process. I think that's really like no other process, you know, because you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath and you begin to enter into like an alternate state of consciousness. For most people, it's an alternate state of consciousness. You know, instead of feeling separate from the world, you begin to interact in the world in a more unified way. This is when meditation feels good, this is why it feels good. Because the boundary between yourself and the world has disappeared, and you're connecting with it with fewer obstructions, fewer sort of hesitations, and there's less distance between you and the world around you. You do enter a kind of alternate state of consciousness, and that state of consciousness is quite complicated, actually, quite sophisticated. You know, one way to think about it is that we go to the edge of the unconscious And if you do zazen, the boundary between yourself and the unconscious mind begins to be more porous or fluid. It begins to open up, and at least in Zen theory, and I would say it's true, you know, the unconscious mind gives us access to much more than the conscious mind. So when we have a problem in Zen, you know, we sit down on the cushion, and we eliminate the barrier between ourselves and the world, and we go to the boundary between the conscious mind and the unconscious mind. And we wait for those two minds to produce a kind of insight or answer to our question. The koan is asking us, this koan is asking us to really engage with this issue of life, and what is life, and what is death, you know. And those are really complicated questions. They seem absolutely self-evident, you know. But they're actually very complicated. You know, so when I sit on the cushion, you know, I do usually enter this state, which is very pleasant, you know, it's very blissful. I've been doing this for 30-some years, so it's relatively easy for me to get to this state of samadhi where I'm the boundary between myself and the world has disappeared. And I feel pretty good. When I'm in this state, you know, one of the things that happens to me is that my body begins to be experienced differently. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but sometimes when you're in deep concentration on the cushion, you'll notice that much of your body doesn't even seem to be present, you know? So you might be, if you're really sitting still and motionless, you might notice that you're aware of, say, your fingertips or your hands and like some of your face. But if your eyes are closed and you're just experiencing your body in samadhi, you might notice that a large portion of it doesn't even seem to be present. Now, you know, in there's many ways to know the body. Right? There's many ways to know the body. You can study the body anatomically, scientifically. You know, you can look in a mirror. But you know, in Zen, we're really all about experiencing things in samadhi. How do you experience things like your body in the immediate moment when you're in a non-divided consciousness? And when you are sitting on the cushion and you're in deep samadhi, you experience your body in a fundamentally different way than you do when you're off the cushions, sitting at your desk or something like that. You know, you'll notice many aspects, many things about your body that you don't normally notice. You know, one aspect of the body is that most of it disappears when you're in deep samadhi. It disappears and it comes back, and it disappears and it comes back. You know, is it there or is it not there? You know, if you had a mirror next to you when you're doing zazen, you could open your eyes and look in the mirror and see your body. But experientially, when you're in deep samadhi and you experience the body, it's more complicated than you think. Because it's present and it's not present. This is Zen. You know, you don't have to accept it. But, you know, if you experience in the mode of experience that is zazen, when you experience your body, it's a complex interplay of presence and absence. It's here and it's not here. And that's how it is. You know, if you focus on your breath, if you focus on your breath when you're meditating, you'll notice that something very strange happens. It might take a while. If you're just doing breath meditation, you're watching the breath, you're watching the breath, you're watching the breath, and you could go through years like that and think, this is, you know, Zen is really stupid. This is really stupid. One day you're watching the breath and suddenly you notice that at the edge of your breath or at the end of your breath, there's like this big empty hole. It's like looking into the mouth of a cave, or you're in a lighted room and there's a dark door at the end of the room and you look into the... You get to the end of your breath and there's this like blankness. Yes? Now, again, you know, this is how Zen people experience the world. You're watching your breath, 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 and then suddenly you notice there are these empty spaces at the end of your breath. You know, what's that all about? You know, there's breath, and then there's the emptiness. And it's like, it's big. You know, if you keep going back to that emptiness, you begin to notice that it seems very capacious, very oceanic. You know, there's this emptiness that we encounter in samadhi, which is quite vast. We don't really, you know, how vast? Please explore. But the point is, you know, the breath exists. I'm just talking about pure Zen experience now. I'm not talking about this as a scientist or a physicist or a philosopher. I'm talking about this as a Zen practitioner. You know, when you watch your breath, it exists and it doesn't exist. And actually, this is the case for many different things. So, you know, if you are doing Zazen, and you hear, say, a best thing in the world illustrate what I'm talking about is if you're in deep samadhi and you hear a bird outside or you hear like birds singing, you know, like repetitively, sometimes in the late, if you do Zazen in the late afternoon, sometimes there's lots of bird action, especially in the spring. And you can just hear all these birds chattering. You know, if you're doing Zazen, it's something you wouldn't normally notice. But if you're doing Zazen, you'll suddenly notice around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the birds go crazy. And they're just chattering away. And if you can, at that time, if you hear something like that, like a bird, repetitive bird sound, and other repetitive sounds will work too. You know, you listen to that sound and you hear it, you hear it, you hear it, you hear it, and all of a sudden it's gone. And you're in a blank place, a dark place, or blankness. You know, this is, anybody who's been doing Zazen for, say, 15 years knows what I'm talking about. You know, these are sort of regular happenings in the world of Zen. If you practice Zazen diligently, these kinds of things happen. And in Zen, we think these are important data, as you would say. You know, these are like important, this is actual information about reality. That's what we believe. You don't have to believe it, but that's what we believe. So you know, actually the fact that when you watch your breath for a while, you get to this great oceanic blankness is in Zen thought to be quite important and significant. And actually, this is thought to be quite important and significant in all of Buddhism. And the Buddha had a lot to say about this blankness. He thought it was quite important. And also, if you listen to a sound, like birds or some kind of repetitive sound, very quickly you will enter into this blankness, and sometimes it can feel like you've just fallen off a cliff. It's quite dramatic. I mean, I've had that experience myself. So, you know, if you ask a Zen person or a Buddhist person, you know, tell me about reality, you know, you're going to get a very complex picture. Because, you know, our ordinary understanding of the world is something is here or something is gone. You know, here, it's gone or gone. But the Zen picture is very complicated because it's here and it's not here at the same time. You know, so this is a complicated picture. Nothing is here, just here. It's here and it's not here, you know. And I'm not, this is not double talk, and it's not, this is like Buddhism 101. You know, if you study physics, one of the things they tell you is that there is, you know, physicists will tell you there isn't really anything called time. Physicists will say that time is really over. You know, when some physicists have said that if you think of the universe as a loaf of bread and you slice the loaf of bread, each of those slices is like a moment in time, but the loaf is already finished. It's already baked. It's out of the oven. It's done. You know, we're moving. We're like going through the slices, but that's our subjective perspective. It's all already done. This is one school of physics. Now, you know, Zen people don't do physics. I barely got through high school physics. Only the kindness of my professor, my teacher, got me through. But I have done a lot of zazen. You know, one of the things that happens in zazen is that, you know, you can get into these, you can be in this place where there is no time. There's just no time. You know, so you've had sits, I'm sure, and because I have had hundreds and hundreds of them, where about halfway through the sit you say, when is this going to be over? You know, please ring the bell. Or, I want to go. You know, I've had enough. This is all the sitting. When I was training with Genki Roshi in Seattle, sometimes I would actually, at the end of the week, it would be like the last day of the week, the last sit of the last day of the week, and I would think, I cannot do one more minute of zazen, or I'm going to scream. But then, you know, I wouldn't scream. I'd be okay. But you get into these states in meditation sometimes where there's no time. And it's absolutely self-evident. It's absolutely self-evident. So, you know, in Zen, in Buddhism, we say that things are not just here or not here. See, things are not. That's a false picture. That's not true. We would say in Buddhism, things are here and they're not here all the time. That everything participates in the condition of being here and not here. And we would also say that everything participates in the condition of being here timelessly and being in time. And this is not metaphysics and it's not philosophy. It's what we experience on the cushion. And if you are a Buddhist, you trust those experiences as indicators of truth. So it's true, you know, that my teacher, Genki Roshi, was born at a certain time, and he died on Sunday. That's true to a degree. That's true to a degree. It's also true that he was here and not here all the time. So sometimes you'll hear people say in Zen, actually, nobody dies in Zen. You know, you heard a Zen teacher say, nobody dies because nobody is ever born. And you can say that's a rationalization, or you can say, what a load of baloney. But actually, that's a very important insight into what it means to be alive right now. You know, there's a way in which we are always living, always being born. There's a way in which we're outside of time, and there's a way in which we have, you know, 60 years or 70 years or 80 years of time. And all three of those things coexist. They coexist. You know, ordinary consciousness is not necessarily right. Just because everybody lives in that place doesn't mean it's real. It just means it's where everybody lives. See? So, you know, if you're on the planet Earth and you look up, the sun appears to move. And for thousands of years, people thought the sun moved. You know, in a certain sense, the sun does move, right? If you're on Earth, it moves. But if you look at the solar system, you realize the sun isn't moving, the Earth is moving. Okay, both of those are true in a certain perspective. But, you know, just because everybody thinks the sun moves doesn't make it so. You know, Buddhism is really like a radical project. You know, you don't have to agree with what Buddhism teaches, but it's not really based on faith. It's not based on ordinary empirical observation. It's based on empirical observation done in deep samadhi. And so, you know, Buddhism takes all of that very seriously. You know, what the Buddha did was zazen, and he reported on reality in ways that don't coincide with what we ordinarily believe. And he tried to explain his insights into reality to people who didn't have those insights. And those are the Pali Sutras and the Sutras and so on. But the Buddhist project is really very complicated because it says you can't trust ordinary consciousness. It's self-centered. It's trapped in destructive mental habits. and it doesn't. It's alienated from the object of consciousness. And Zazen says, the picture of reality that you get in that world is a false, is to some degree true, but to some degree false. And it says, if you want to understand reality from the Buddhist standpoint, please notice some of these aspects of reality. And one of the aspects of reality is that you're here and you're not here all the time. Or you're here and not here, you could say simultaneously, or, you know, so they're sort of like alternating. So, you know, there's a kind, this is not metaphysics and it's not poetry. There's a kind of non-existence right at the heart of existence. And it's constantly there. And existence and non-existence are like waves on the ocean. Or existence is like a wave on the ocean of non-existence. This is really how it looks if you do a lot of Zazen. So this is the Buddhist view. So it's true, you know, when people die in the Buddhist world, they cremate them, and they have ceremonies for them, and they recite sutras for them. And in a certain sense, somebody really is here for 80 years, and then they're gone. And that's true. That's true, but it's like one aspect of a more complicated reality. And so there are Buddhists who believe in tushita heaven. They believe that when you die, you go to heaven. And that's fine. That I myself have not been to heaven. You know, I don't remember being in heaven, so I can't report on that. But having done a lot of Zazen, the report on reality from the standpoint of Zazen is that it makes some sense to say there is no birth and there is no death as we conventionally think of them. Because actually, existence and non-existence have a complex relationship. So if a Zen master says to you, you can't die because you were never born, that could be just so much baloney. But actually, that person that he or she is reporting accurately on reality as experienced in deep samadhi, looked at very, very carefully. So, you know, I don't know if this makes us less sad when somebody dies or not. Probably not, you know. You know, when somebody dies, you know, it's okay to be very sad. It's okay. You know, when my father died, I really just wept. It really shocked me, you know. Because we had a complex relationship, you know. I didn't really necessarily like my father that much. But when he died, maybe because of that, I cried like a... I just couldn't stop crying. You know, so I think that's okay. I don't think that's a mistake or some kind of failure. I don't think you should try to stifle your emotions and say everything is one or something. If you feel like crying, it's okay to cry. But I also think, you know... one of the most amazing things about this relationship between something and nothing is that, you know, this nothingness that we experience on the cushion is really quite energizing. And it's really quite, you know, when we think of nothingness, you know, we think it must be this horrible thing. You know, emptiness, blankness, this is so depressing, you know, Zen is... But when you get into it, you suddenly realize there's a kind of indestructibility to life. That in the middle of this emptiness, it's just like crackling with life. And again, I'm not a philosopher, and I'm not telling you about something in the scriptures. If you spend a lot of time in that emptiness, you suddenly notice that it's crackling with life. It's pulsing with life energy. I have been sad in my life, really like sad. And when my mother died, especially, you know, I loved my mother. I used to talk to her every week on the phone. And when I actually found myself like, I can't call my mother anymore. I was so sad. But, you know, you get on the cushion and you get into this blankness and it's crackling with life. And you realize that it, you know, from the Zen standpoint, life is indestructible. There is no, from the Zen standpoint, there is no birth and there is no death. That's from the Zen standpoint, that is a true statement. It doesn't mean the people we love don't die. It doesn't mean we shouldn't cry for them. That's part of being a human being. It doesn't mean we shouldn't sit over their body and observe rituals of our ancestors. But there's another aspect to all this, you know? There's another aspect. So, you know, the Zen approach is to go into samadhi and explore reality. So when Genki-san died, you know, I sat on the cushion and I did what I have trained to do for 37 years. And it's a different experience. You know, I felt very sad that he died. I loved him. He was a very kind person, and he was like the Dalai Lama for me. You know, he taught me that it was possible to live a better life than I was living. You know, and he showed me how to sit. But there's a deeper element to all this. The Zen approach is to ask what is life, what is death, from the standpoint of samadhi. And the answers we get are quite different from ordinary consciousness. I'm not putting down ordinary consciousness. But I think it's really quite remarkable. The Zen teaching is really that in the middle of that dark, of the blankest blankness, in the middle of the emptiest emptiness, there's this life energy that comes out. This is why when people call Mu, sometimes you tap into that life energy. It's crackling with energy. It's like life, you know, is indestructible in a certain way. And it always present. Yeah? Tosatsu Etsu Osho set up three barriers for his disciples. You leave no stone unturned to explore reality. Simply to see into your true nature. Now I want to ask you, and you can ask yourselves this too, just at this moment, what is your true nature? If you don't know the answer to that, please do more zazen. Okay. Question two. If you realize your true nature, you are free from life and death. Tell me, when your eyesight deserts you at the last moment, how can you be free from birth and death? If you don't know, please do more zazen. Three, when you set yourself free from life and death, you should know your ultimate destination. So when the four elements separate, in other words, when your body falls apart, where will you go? Now, the Zen teaching is that you can figure it out on the cushion. That's the Zen teaching. So the Zen teaching is if you want to understand life, zazen. If you want to understand death, zazen. The Zen teaching is the answer is really and truly there. Death is right here next to you. Life is right here next to you. Investigate. Mumon's comment. If you can put turning words to these three questions, you are the master wherever you may stand and command Zen whatever circumstances you may be in. If otherwise, if that's not the case yet, listen. Gulping down your mirror will fill you easily. So you know, it's terrible, terrible to experience the death of somebody we love. And it's possible that you're in so much pain, that you just cover, you draw the bedclothes over the body. And you say, gone to a better place, rest in peace, etc., etc. There's nothing wrong with that. It's very important. On the other hand, when somebody dies, this is a real challenge to us, right? It means, what is life? What is death? Certain kind of person has to know. If you're that kind of person, then Zen is probably your path. Yeah, I know. Yeah, okay, people die, and it's terrible. Help me get through this. Yes, fine. Very important. But what is life? What is death? If you have to know, please do more zazen. You can gulp your meal down, and it will fill you. But chewing it, chew on it, that can sustain you. Okay, Mumon's verse. This moment's thought sees through eternal time. Eternal time is just this moment. If you see through this moment's thought, you see through the person who sees through this thought.